A hazmat team responded to a rail car chemical leak in Great Falls. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you why the Montana State University campus was locked down for part of the day. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks issues with Congressman Steve Daines, who is running in the Republican primary for U.S. Senate. A Great Falls Fire Rescue Hazmat Team has determined a rail car's chemical fume leak poses no environmental or public health risk, according to the Great Falls Tribune. Police Sergeant Doug Malam says no injuries have been reported. Authorities say Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway employees reported a strange smell this afternoon around a rail car near the Hickory Swing Golf Course. GFFR Fire Marshal Dirk Johnson said the rail car was originally thought to contain 100 to 200 gallons of sodium hydrosulfide solution. This is a potentially flammable substance and can be a health concern if in direct bodily contact. Authorities have blocked a portion of the road and set up cones around the perimeter of the car. Authorities say the car was headed to the Calumet Refinery in Great Falls.
And in other news from around the state, Montana State University officials say a lockdown has been lifted after police found nobody matching the description of two men reported to be carrying a rifle on campus. Spokesman Tracy Ellig says a sweep of the campus turned up no immediate threat this morning. An alert sent by the university says police received a report the men were walking toward the center of campus with a rifle. Police and FBI agents searched buildings and told people to stay inside and lock their doors. Ellig says two men matching the description were briefly detained, but they were released after their car was searched. Students are allowed to keep firearms in locked facilities. Ellig says officials believe a student may have retrieved a rifle while moving out for the end of the school year.
Montana Department of Transportation Director Mike Tooley says there are two issues in which intolerance should not only be permissible, but encouraged. Those topics, impaired driving and not using seatbelts. Tooley was in Missoula today to kick off MDOT's new Vision Zero initiative for Montana highway fatalities. Stats provided by the Montana Department of Transportation show that in the last 10 years, 1,293 people killed in vehicle crashes were either not wearing a seatbelt or wearing one improperly. 1,054 fatalities involved a driver impaired by drugs, alcohol, or a combination of both. Tooley, a former Montana Highway Patrol trooper, says the Vision Zero initiative aims for just that, zero deaths on our roads and highways. He says it really is an achievable goal.
Vision Zero is a goal, but just as important, it's a mindset and a change to our culture. It's no longer about shrugging our shoulders when we see that someone died in a traffic crash on the back page of the newspaper, or when we hear about someone who didn't wear his or her seatbelt and was thrown from a car and died. It's no longer about being tolerant of a drunk driver killing innocent Montanans. It's about refusing to accept pointless and tragic death on our highways.
MDOT will kick off a media campaign later this month featuring graphic billboards with depictions of a young car crash victim. Television ads will feature a mother mourning the loss of her son. Inspirational messages will be featured online. Law enforcement will also mobilize between May 19th and June 1st, increasing patrols to encourage seatbelt use and catch drivers who are under the influence. Tooley adds MDOT's engineering division will work to ensure the state's roads are built and maintained with safety as a primary concern. And he says grants will help ensure emergency responders are adequately funded, equipped, and trained. Speakers at today's press event offered dramatic testimony on how their lives and the lives of their children have been spared by seatbelt use in severe accidents.
Montana's Attorney General says he supports keeping a 6-foot-tall statue of Jesus on U.S. Forest Service land next to a Whitefish ski hill. Attorney General Tim Fox filed a friend of the court brief today with the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals as it considers a legal challenge by an atheist and agnostic organization. Fox is asking the court to uphold a federal judge's August ruling that allows the Forest Service to renew a permit for the statue at Whitefish Mountain Resort. U.S. District Judge Dana Christensen says the statue is used more for photo opportunities and as a meeting point than for religious reflection. The Freedom From Religious Foundation wants the appellate court to overturn the decision, saying the statue on federal land violates the constitutional separation of church and state.
With the biggest war chest and the most name recognition, Congressman Steve Daines has a clear edge over his opponents, Champ Edmonds and Susan Cundiff, in the Republican U.S. Senate primary. The former Bozeman businessman is serving his first and possibly last term as Montana's lone representative in the U.S. House. Now he wants to win the Senate seat, long held by Democrat Max Baucus, back for the Republican Party. In this feature interview, Daines talks with news director Sally Mock about his campaign and about some of the current issues facing Congress.
I know that as you've gone around Montana, you've been getting an earful about the Affordable Care Act for months now. The act has signed up 8 million Americans and 36,000 Montanans at this point. You still favor repeal?
I do, yeah. And I've certainly, as you said, getting an earful from Montana as we travel the state. In fact, this morning I was in Helena meeting with the Montana Chamber of Commerce and some of their board members as well as some business leaders there. And just concerns, some of the uncertainty, what's going on perhaps with premiums, what's going on as it relates to the incentives in the system here to drive better value of trying to lower costs and improve outcomes. The director of the Congressional Budget Office talked about that they estimate that the Affordable Care Act will cost some 2 million jobs over the course of the next 10 years. This is coming from the CBO. And so they're just concerns what this might do. The provisions of the 29-hour, the 30-hour work week, so they call them the 29ers now. They have to work 29 hours because they get the 30 hours considered full-time employees, what that's doing right now to jobs. So I've been hearing a lot from Montanans, a lot of concerns, and consequently I think we need something that's not a Washington, D.C.-led solution, something that probably comes from more from Montana.
What would you do with those 8 million Americans and 36,000 Montanans who signed up if it was repealed?
Well, clearly, I mean, just as we had, there was a period of time here to ramp up a system. We need to stay focused, I think, on one, how do we deal with the fact that there's millions of Americans that are not insured and can't afford it? And two, ultimately, how do we continue to drive the costs down and the outcomes up? And from the reports I've seen from the CBO and others, it looks like the Affordable Care Act is not going to achieve those objectives. The CBO reports show they're still going to have millions and millions of Americans that are uninsured. Even post-ACA. And so as an engineer, you know, Sally, I went to MSU, and I'm the only I'm one of six engineers in Congress. I stay focused on what problem are we trying to solve, and let's make sure that the policies in place here really are solving those problems.
I want to move on to the Ryan budget, which you support. That's the budget in the House. It would balance the budget in 10 years, and it would do that by cutting some programs like Medicaid, food stamps, and Pell Grants.
First of all, the House did pass a budget. One of the primary responsibilities of Congress, like it is in our family businesses, in our home budgets, is to actually pass a budget. And so there were multiple budgets presented, and there's no one budget I'll ever agree with entirely, including the Ryan budget. But I think it's very important that the American people expect that their leaders back in Washington pass a budget. And the president proposed a budget. It was defeated 413-2 on the House floor. The Ryan budget did pass, and it does show balance. But what I'm concerned about is that the Senate is not going to pass a budget.
It's not going to pass the Ryan budget.
Well, they're not going to pass any budget. So the Senate is not going to pass a budget. And that's concerning. 2 years ago, the Senate had gone many years without passing a budget. In fact, one of the comments made in Washington was the last time the U.S. Senate passed a budget, the iPad hadn't been invented yet. And so I think whether you agree with the budget or not, it's important, first of all, that the Congress has the courage to put a budget out there and to pass it for debate. But the Senate is not going to pass a budget, and frankly, that's very concerning to me.
Okay. Let's stick with what the House is doing. But it does cut Medicaid, food stamps, and Pell Grant funding. What do you say to the folks who are getting that funding now? What are they supposed to do in those cuts?
Well, you look at, for example, on the SNAP program went from $33 billion back in 2006 to nearly $80 billion here most recently. So it's seen tremendous growth in the spending. And the spending in Washington is just not sustainable. We look at what's going on with some nearly now $18 trillion of debt. And we are passing on a debt to our children and grandchildren here that I think is morally wrong. And so it's it's I don't want to look at my kids and grandkids and tell them that, you know, here's our credit card debt. You go deal with it in the next generation. I think we need to continue to look for ways to reduce some of this wasteful spending. These programs are not being eliminated at all. There's merit in these very, very important programs here. There's been significant growth in these programs, certainly, you know, over the last 5 or 6 years.
But the cuts are significant. It's $700 billion in Medicaid. Those are significant cuts. So my question is, who makes up those cuts?
Yeah, well typically those are reductions in increases as it relates to the way the federal government manages its budget. As we watch, and I've learned back in Washington, you know, a lot of Washington, D.C. spending occurs the last week of the fiscal year, which the government operates on a September 30th fiscal. And why is that? Because the leaders of those budgets are incentivized to spend their budgets or they lose them. And that's not a sustainable – that's not the way it works usually in the private sector. And that's why in places like Montana and our state, we run budget surpluses. We're required to balance our budget. I think we need that same kind of discipline in Washington. And these programs, these important safety nets, we're not proposing eliminating them. We're proposing we've got to figure out ways here to insist upon doing more with less. Look at the bureaucracies. In fact, we just had this conversation today on Medicare and Medicaid that some 30% of the dollars for these programs get absorbed in the bureaucracies before they ever get down to the people here who need the care.
Congressman, the debate isn't over whether the budget needs to be balanced. The debate is over how, and that's what I want to keep focused on. The Ryan budget would also cut taxes on the wealthy. And one Democratic congressman says, quote, that the budget would suck the blood out of the middle class.
Well, I think most most Americans believe that the current income tax and the tax structure is far too complicated. And so we're looking at how do you reform these systems here. That they say that the income tax code today is 10 times bigger than the Bible without the good news. And so, you know, we got to look at ways here. How do we broaden and simplify the tax code, looking at ways to remove some of the loopholes too. So in exchange for some of the rate reductions, there's also looking at ways to remove some of the tax loopholes as well. And so I think that's all part of trying to figure out ways to reform and simplify the tax code so that we can maintain competitiveness here long term, so the United States can keep more jobs here in America instead of exporting jobs overseas.
In terms of some of the environmental issues that are before Congress, I want to switch gears a little bit with you now. In the Senate, there's a bill to reauthorize and fund the Land and Water Conservation Act. It's an act that has funded a ton of projects in Montana, and groups all across the board support funding for that act. Do you support the reauthorization and funding of that act, and what do you plan to do about that in the House?
Yeah, I do. In fact, that was one of the programs I spent a lot of time meeting with various groups across Montana that are passionate about our public lands, that are passionate about, you know, sportsmen in particular as well, whether it's Trout Unlimited and Ducks Unlimited or the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And I'm a, you know, as a fifth generation Montana, someone who loves spending time outdoors and hunting and fishing, I've supported the LWCF, and I'm on record for doing so.
Will you co-sponsor a bill in the House on that? Or?
Yes, I am. In fact, if I'm not on that bill, I believe it will be on that bill. The LWCF, yep.
The other act that is of great interest to Montanans is the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act, which would create some new wilderness along the Rocky Mountain Front, has widespread support in the area along the Rocky Mountain Front among different interest groups. You haven't come out in support or opposition of that yet.
Yeah, you know, when I go back to Washington and represent the people of Montana, you're representing a million Montanans, you go down and cast that vote, or whether it's on the floor or in a committee hearing. You know, the Rocky Mountain Front's a very special place. Literally, my great-great-grandmother homesteaded about 50 miles as the crow flies from Shodo. Woke up every morning looking at that amazing vista. And I've spent a lot of time above 9 and 10,000 feet growing up in Montana and passionate about the outdoors and wilderness experiences. In fact, we had just had our staff back up there this past week, you know, engaging more folks on both sides on that issue. There's some that are very passionate for moving forward in the Heritage Act. There's still some that have some concerns about some of the grazing issues of some of our ranchers. And so for me, it's about how do we develop some consensus here and how do we marry something like this bill with some of the broad timber reforms that you know, we passed one in the House. It's H.R. 1526. And so I think we're going to have to be looking at the fact that the pendulum has swung in the direction of Montana of locking up our public lands to responsible natural resource development. I think that issue has to get addressed as well. And so I want to see some timber reforms passed And I'm still keeping an open mind, certainly, on the Rocky Mountain Heritage Act. Just realize that there are some, especially some of our ranchers and some folks in the area there that have concerns about some of the grazing restrictions.
It sounds like you wouldn't support the act unless it was married to some kind of timber act.
Well, I think pragmatically speaking, Sally, in Washington, you know, how do we make progress if actually get something done? You know, as you know—
That's a good question.
It is. And as you know, we got the North Fork of the Flathead Watershed Project passed. You know, that was, I worked out with Senator Baucus when I first came back to Congress here 16 months ago. You know, Max has been working on that bill for 25 years.
Probably. The Rocky Mountain Front Act is one that he would like to see passed too.
Well, right, but we started with the North Fork. That bill never ever passed the Senate, Sally. It never passed the House. I got it passed through the House, which was the first time it's passed either chamber in 30 years. And that's a very important first step, I think, in a good conservation bill that we had consensus on up there in the Flathead. And so I think if we're going to get something done, it's going to have to be bipartisan. I think it's going to have to require some kind of public lands package that really addresses this issue of the fact that, you know, our timber harvests in our state are down 90% from where they were, you know, back in the late 80s. And what has that done to our small communities in Montana? We have these communities there in western Montana surrounded by federal lands who have lost their timber industry, lost their revenues for their schools and infrastructure, and are struggling economically. And frankly, I think you know, good timber management practices actually produce healthier forests and reduce risk of catastrophic wildfire.
I'll just beat this dead horse one more time.
Sure.
Will you support the Rocky Mountain Front Heritage Act unless it's tied to other legislation?
Well, I think, again, first of all, we're working right now. In fact, I had staff up there this past week engaging with the folks who live closest to who are going to be impacted by the Heritage Act, looking at some restrictions there, some trouble with some of the grazing provisions and so forth. And I think we're making some progress here, trying to build some consensus. I think just looking at the dynamics in Washington, pragmatically speaking, it's probably going to take a marriage between some significant timber reform to allow more access to our public lands for timber harvest with some kind of a greater public lands package. So, that's probably going to be a marriage made in a conference committee between the Senate and the House if we're going to really get something done here and put it on the president's desk.
You mentioned a timber bill that did pass the House that you supported, mm-hmm. and you mentioned that bill in a campaign ad and say that you've passed legislation to create 6,000 timber jobs. Mm-hmm. That bill did pass the House. It's going nowhere in the Senate.
Yeah, and there's a couple of similar bills right now in the Senate that we'd like to see get through their committees to get through the Senate so we could ultimately get a bill on the president's desk. And that gets back to that earlier conversation. Absolutely. It's going to have to be something there out of the Senate. There's a couple that, that kind of – I know Senator Barrasso has one of them from Wyoming. But if you remember Schoolhouse Rock, I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. It's going to require the bill moving through the House. We've got it done in the House. And that's a major step. You know, there's thousands and thousands of bills being introduced. To get a bill actually through committee and through the House is a pretty limited subset number of piece of legislation.
Do you think it's misleading to have a campaign ad, though, saying you passed legislation when, in fact, it only passed the House?
Well, we're not trying to mislead anybody on that. We passed the House of Representatives. I mean, that's what—
But that's not what the ad says.
We passed legislation in the House. We did that.
It doesn't say in the House is all I'm saying.
Okay.
And let's switch to the campaign now. You've been endorsed by the Tea Party. Do you endorse them?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing I've learned is I'm grateful that there are many groups out there that believe in more jobs and less government. And in fact, I think that, you know, many, many Montanans are very concerned about the overreach of this federal government, the explosive growth in regulation, certainly in spending. And I'm, you know, grateful to have the support, have Tea Party support, but we've got, you know, independent support. We have a lot of Democrats supporting us. We have union members supporting us, conservation groups supporting us, conservation members, I would say, on that. And so I look at it pretty pragmatically. You know, in Montana, we're usually not so tied to labels or an R or a D behind your name. It's like who's best going to represent Montana? And it's a complex equation. There's a lot of competing interests out there.
But there are a lot of people who would like to know that, in fact, you support what the Tea Party stands
for. Well, I'm grateful for their support. I mean, they believe in more jobs and less government. That's what I stand for. And there's going to be many, many groups that are getting behind our campaign. And I'm grateful to have a very diverse group of Montanans that support what we're doing.
You've raised, I think, over $1 million this year already for the campaign, mm-hmm. $1.2 million from individuals, corporations, and PACs. The average voter does not believe that money, especially from wealthy donors, isn't buying votes.
Yeah, I have not met, I think, a single Montanan who believes there's not enough money in politics. You look at that last race between John Tester and Denny Rehberg. I think John Tester raised $13 million. and Danny Rehberg raised $9 million.
I mean, if you win the primary, this race could exceed that.
It could. It really could.
Probably
and,
will.
And we'll see what happens on that. But clearly, there'll be a lot of money probably pouring into Montana from outside groups. It's the nature of I think the reality of some of these Senate races all across the country. We're already seeing it today. So it's I don't think any one party has a corner on that issue. In fact, typically the Democrats outraise the Republicans looking at it in terms on dollars. But I think the bottom line is this: there's too much money spent in politics, and I think this Senate campaign there will be millions of dollars spent. It's historically been true, and probably true in the future too.
You, I believe, support the recent Supreme Court decisions on campaign spending, but you call for more transparency. Am I reading that correctly?
Yeah, I do. I think the what's important there is the voters deserve to see who's getting behind different candidates. I think that's the reforms
from
the transparency. Well, although with that ruling, what that did is it actually probably put more money into transparency, because when these donors hit their federal limits.
You're talking about the McCutcheon rule.
Correct. When the donors hit the federal limits, where would they put their extra dollars? Into groups didn't have to report. Now, if they're going to give some extra dollars, that has to be reported through the FEC reports. And I think that creates some transparency. But clearly, I think it's important that we try to level the playing field so that all groups would be held accountable to the same standard.
Just have one more question, sure. And this is about an issue that isn't necessarily a federal issue. It's a state issue, mm-hmm. but it's one that's certainly touching a lot of people in Montana right now, and that's the Stand Your Ground laws that mm-hmm. have been changed in Montana and elsewhere around the country. And recently there's been a German exchange student shot and killed in Missoula, and the Castle Doctrine will probably apply to that case. I wonder what your opinion of all that is.
Well, it's such a tragic situation here, truly, in Missoula. And I think, first of all, on that particular issue, I want to wait and see what the facts are on that in terms of the background, both on the gentleman that fired the shots, a student. We need to see all the facts before I think we come to any judgment. And I hope we don't take some of this to truly start to politicize an issue here relating to the Second Amendment. And so I think first and foremost, we respect the fact that there was a young man who was killed. There's another man who's been maybe charged here.
Deliberate homicide.
Correct. Yeah. And so I think let's hold our opinions, at least on this issue, until we get all the facts on it. Pivoting over to the issue in the Second Amendment, I'm a passionate defender, certainly, of the Second Amendment and ensuring that the federal government does not infringe on our rights to keep and bear arms. But I just would hope this tragic situation in Missoula wouldn't be used as something, as a political issue here to drive a point one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Any concerns that the Second Amendment, that defense of that, has gone too far in one direction?
Well, I don't want this in any way to connect what happened in Missoula. That's a tragic situation. But kind of stepping back, I think, on the debate, I'm a firm supporter and protector of the Second Amendment. There's a reason why it was the Second Amendment, behind the First Amendment, which was a very, very important amendment related to freedom of religion and speech and assembly and so forth and petition. But I'm concerned that we have a federal government that oftentimes tends to react to situations in this country, and they look to perhaps putting more laws and regulations on legal abiding gun owners. Montana's been very, very clear that they don't want to see that, the majority of Montanans, and I'll continue to be a strong protector of the Second Amendment. It's a very high standard, Sally. It says, shall not infringe. And that's a very, very high standard. And as I hold up my hand and take the oath to defend the Constitution, it also means defending the Second Amendment.
We have been speaking with Congressman Steve Daines, who is also running in the Republican primary race for U.S. Senate. Congressman, always a pleasure to have you in our studio. Thank you.
Thanks, Sally. Good to be here.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be partly cloudy with isolated rain and lows in the mid-20s to lower 30s. Tomorrow expect partly cloudy skies with highs in the 60s. For central Montana tonight, look for partly cloudy skies, mountain snow in the evening, and lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be sunny with highs 55 to 65 degrees. For southwest Montana tonight, expect mostly cloudy skies in the evening, becoming partly cloudy with scattered rain and snow, with lows 20 to 30 degrees, and tomorrow should be sunny with highs 55 to 65 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Patricia Rosenleaf.
Whenever I might feel as if life is too rough for me or that things just aren't going my way, I have to remind myself that of all the people in the world, I am in the top 5% for the life I've led. When you figure the population of the entire world, which exceeded 7 billion souls on March 12, 2014, and then consider that you and I are in the top 5%, you no longer can feel sorry for yourself. You're not allowed to feel sorry for yourself, in fact. Someone needs to slap you if you're having those feelings in excessive amounts. Ask yourselves the following. Were you born into a family where at least one other person looked out for you and loved you? If so, you're rising to the top as I speak. Did your family educate you in the ways of society? Did they house train you and teach you to say thank you and please and form you into a decent human being? Did you receive a free education, notwithstanding the yearly sales of candy or magazines that your family was saddled with buying? Could you have chosen to go on with that education? True, it might have meant some sacrifice on your part for a number of years, but still, wasn't it out there for us? Did you have enough to eat every day, a warm place to lay your head at night, and a shelter during the storms and bad weather that occurred during your life? Did you, at the flip of a switch, have light in your darkened shelter? Could you, with the twist of your wrist, turn on water that slaked your thirst, bathed you, washed your face, and help you to clean your teeth? Was the water clean and clear, and did it taste good? Did you have indoor facilities in which to clear your body of waste? And then, were you able to flush it away with a flick of your fingers on the flusher? Did you have immediate access to medical help if you needed it? My Aunt May died of appendicitis because she lived too far from town to get help. 50 years later, I was saved from the same affliction by the attention of doctors and nurses who were able to decide what was wrong with me and take the correct steps to fix it. Did your family own a car that could take you not only to work or school, but also on vacations at times, even if it was just a daycation of a picnic to a beach or a forest? Were you lucky enough to have a furry animal as a companion, one that was never in danger of being eaten by your starving family and upon whom you showered love and affection? Did you and do you now have the support of not only whatever comprises your family, but also of people whose friendship you have inculcated and nurtured? Do you have at least one or two friends upon whom you can call at any time for help, love, or succor? Were you lucky enough to have been born in Montana, one of the most beautiful states, where most people can look out a window and see trees and grass, mountains, plains, a fair sky? Well, not always that, but still. If you weren't born here, somehow you made your way to this state and can enjoy the amenities of our wonderful state, whether it's through just observing our beautiful scenery, historical places, or participating in hiking, camping, fishing, joyriding, boating, water skiing. True, you have to be quick about that sport. Skiing, or just tromping around in a forest, where if you walk far enough, you can convince yourself that you might be the first person ever to trod in that place. Beyond our state, we were born in the United States of America. We've had our trials and travails, but by and large, how lucky are we to be United States citizens? Over 1 million people a year become legal U.S. citizens. Estimates are that there are 20 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. Why do you suppose they want to be here? Well, duh, for better jobs, better working conditions, a better system of government than the places where their very lives were lived in fear of death from day to day, better lives for their children, better schools, the list goes on. And if we don't like conditions as they exist, what's our recourse? Why, we can get off our duffs and vote out anyone we want who happens to be up for election. How many people in the world can solve their problems that easily? Further, you can write letters to the editor or to your congresspeople and express your displeasure. If there are enough of you who agree on any one topic, you can even effect a change. You can form a union and demand better pay or better benefits, and all without the fear of being taken out of your house in the middle of the night, never to be heard from again. You can boycott products that you don't like, businesses that displease you, television programs. Think of what can be changed by just a few minds working out solutions to problems. In fact, we're so full of our own sense of entitlement that we're beyond arrogant, and frankly, that's a definite backlash of living in a country such as ours, that arrogant smell, I mean. Now, just for a minute, think of all those aforementioned gifts that you were showered with, and then consider how many millions of people don't have even one of those things we all take for granted. Think of the people in war-torn countries where children are conscripted into service and forced to shoot and kill others, stripping them of any vestige of a childhood or the chance at a normal adulthood. Think of the children whose parents have been taken away or who never knew their parents, or the people who have suffered through the vicissitudes of weather and natural disasters. Think of the refugees who have lived for years in camps meant for the short term. Then consider your own life and the luck that brought you where you are today. Because if you could answer yes to most of the questions I asked above, you are among the top 5% of lucky people on the planet. Notice there was no mention of money in those questions, because if you had those things, having enough or more than enough money is mere icing on the cake of your life. You might be thinking about how you can share a little of that good fortune, but that's fodder for another day. This is Patricia Rosenleaf, one of the luckiest people in the world, who counts her fortunate circumstances every day.
Patricia Rosenleaf is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed don't necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.